Welcome to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. The Everything Financial Radio program is brought to you by PLP Services. You know, as I begin the program today, I want to let everybody know that the Everything Financial Radio program will be coming to an end. And the reason for that is that we are going to devote more time developing other resources, many of them free resources, to help get the message out. If you've been a longtime listener to the Everything Financial Radio program, you know that we believe that economies and money move in cycles, and these cycles are predictable, and where we go from here is predictable. If you've not yet read a copy of my new Retirement Rules book, I'd encourage you to go to Amazon and pick up a copy. I believe we still have a Kindle version there for 99 cents. Check it out. I believe that the information in the book is extremely important, and we intend to do more communication along those lines moving ahead. Now, on today's program, I'll be chatting momentarily with Mr. Carl Denninger. I caught up with Carl this past week to talk with him about if the repeal and replacement of Obamacare will produce good results for the American people, in his opinion. And I think what he has to say is very enlightening, and he really just looks at it from a math perspective. So I would encourage you to stay tuned and listen to that conversation I'm going to have with Carl Denninger momentarily. If you'd like to remain apprised as to the free resources that we have available here, I would encourage you to sign up for our newsletter. It's titled Portfolio Watch, and you can sign up for the Portfolio Watch newsletter by visiting the website yourportfoliowatch.com. The website is your, Y-O-U-R, portfoliowatch.com. When you go there, you can sign up for the newsletter, and as resources become available, we will let you know about it in the newsletter. The newsletter is delivered via email. You'll get it every Monday at 5 o'clock Eastern, and we'd encourage you to go sign up. Again, the website, yourportfoliowatch.com. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Carl Denninger. You can read Carl's blog at market-ticker.org, and I would encourage you to check it out. Love reading Carl's perspective. And, Carl, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me on, Dennis.
Hey, Carl, here we are post-election. The stock market seems to have responded favorably. Do you think that we're in for 4 years of prosperity?
No, I think we're in for 4 years of ruin, and it's probably going to come within the next year or two. The market has taken a a rather interesting view of things that I believe is going to be proved out to be extraordinarily overly exuberant. The appointments we've gotten so far within the transition team from Trump's administration strongly suggest that he's not only not going to do anything about the medical cost issue, that it's probably going to accelerate in severity. And just to remind listeners, that's the issue that within the next 4 years, if it's not dealt with, is going to destroy the federal budget. So, and that's mathematics, it's not politics. So this is a major problem.
Let's for our listeners maybe that aren't familiar with, you know, the magnitude of this issue and the math behind the issue, explain.
The federal government last year spent about $3.8 trillion. That's the fiscal year that ends in September. And of that last year, $1,417 billion of it, which is about 37%, was spent on Medicare and Medicaid. So if you take those two programs and you add them up, that's the amount that's there. And this is off the Treasury's own Treasury monthly statement. They produce a nice monthly financial statement that goes through all of this. And so everything that the Treasury spends, which is all the money the government spends, is delineated there by department and function. The problem is that that's a 9.3% increase over last year's figures, and that is a trend that has been going on for the last 30 years. Obamacare bought 2 years of very small increases in those two programs, not the previous fiscal, but the two prior years to that. So we had a two-year lull in this, which is why you have heard President Obama say that we slowed the growth of this. But he got 2 years out of it, and then it resumed its former trajectory. And the last two fiscal years, it's been expanding at approximately 9%. To put some other internal numbers on this, Medicare Part D, which is the drug benefit for seniors, increased last year by 26.2%. I think you can figure out how long we can sustain a 26% growth rate. That would be like not at all, right? The total of that spending last year was $96 billion approximately, but at a 26% growth rate, it isn't going to be $90 billion for very long. The problem here is that in 4 years, if you compound 9.3% over 4 years, that's a 42.7% increase. So we're going to try to spend $2,000 billion, $2 trillion, by the time that, well, before President Trump's first term ends, because that would be the end of the fiscal year in 2020, which is in September. The problem with trying to do that is that that's a $600 billion a year additional hole in the federal budget deficit. We're not going to get away with that.
So, Carl, how does this play out? I mean, there's talk about repealing and replacing Obamacare, which I think was probably one of the three major factors in Trump's win. Everybody says, hey, we don't like Obamacare. Premiums are going through the roof. But, you know, what's the alternative? How does this thing get fixed, or can it be fixed?
Repealing and replacing Obamacare will not only not fix the problem, it'll make it worse. The issue here is that you have monopolist practices in the health industry, both within the insurance companies and within the healthcare providers and drug firms themselves, which in any other industry people would be in prison for, and in fact are illegal for the most part. There are exceptions in a few places for the insurance firms, and there are some exceptions for the drug firms with regards to reimportation across the national boundaries, because there were specific laws passed for that. But in all other cases, there's a 100-plus-year-old body of law called 15 United States Code that makes these practices illegal. Nobody's been indicted for any of this. Nobody's been prosecuted in any sort of way. And yet, if we don't do it, we're going to have a collapse in the federal funding model, not to mention in the private economy. And this is why you have costs in the medical system that are going up at, you know, 4, 5, 6, 10 times the rate of inflation. And it's why an MRI that you can buy for cash in Japan for $100 can't be had for under $1,000 in the United States.
So, Carl, you know, a listener that, and we've talked about this in the past on the program, we've got a lot of new listeners as well, it's got to strike a listener as just ludicrous that if there's a medical service or a drug being offered for a fraction of the cost somewhere else versus in the United States, that this would be a pretty easy fix if we just let common sense prevail.
It would be an easy fix, but you have to realize what the consequences of it are. First is that the lobbying groups in Washington, D.C. with regards to this are extremely powerful. The second problem is that if you take currently the medical industry is about 19% of GDP. It'll be 20 within the next year or two. If you were to take that and essentially take a hatchet to it, and by fixing this problem, you would cut the cost of medical care in this country somewhere in the neighborhood of 80% on a gross basis. That would mean that we would take about a 15% reduction in GDP immediately. Now, that wouldn't stay there for very long, because you'd have that money would get reallocated into other areas of the economy. It would make us far more competitive on the world stage, so you'd have a huge amount of inflow of manufacturing jobs as well as administrative stuff that would come back here. But in the short term, the economic pain that would come from this in the form of an extremely deep and immediate recession would be very real. And so essentially what you'd be doing is intentionally taking a very deep but short recession in order to restore balance and save not only the federal budget, but also all state and local pensions and ultimately the American economy. And none of these people in Congress none of the people in Washington are even willing to take this up as a point of debate.
Well, we're chatting today with Carl Denninger. His blog can be read at market-ticker.org. I would encourage you to check it out. We will continue our conversation with Carl when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. Glad you decided to tune in today. Hey, before I get back to my conversation with Carl Denninger, if you're just joining us, the Everything Financial Radio program will be coming to an end very soon. We're doing that to allow us to spend more time writing and developing resources to reach even more people. If you'd like to know about these resources as they become available, the easiest way to do that is just become a subscriber to our newsletter. It is delivered via email every week. The newsletter is titled Portfolio Watch, and you can become a subscriber by simply visiting yourportfoliowatch.com. That's Y-O-U-R, yourportfoliowatch.com. I'm chatting today with Carl Denninger. Carl's blog can be read at market-ticker.org. Carl is a frequent guest here on the program and always appreciate his perspective. And in the last segment, Carl, we were talking about the fact that no one in Washington seems to want to address this, what will be an inevitable collapse, if you will, in the whole medical system as far as costs are concerned. You stated something that I thought was remarkable in the last segment, and that is that within a couple years, medical costs will comprise 20% of gross domestic product. I mean, how far can this rubber band actually stretch?
I don't know. What I know is that we won't get away with trying to finance another $600 billion a year in deficits, and that will happen within the next 4 years. And that's a structural deficit that will never go away. It just simply keeps expanding on a geometric basis. So the market will come to this realization once it gets over the euphoria of, you know, oh, Trump's going to fix the world, and start seeing that, oh, wait a minute, we've got this budget problem, and it's not going to get fixed. And oh, by the way, they're just going to uncap the debt ceiling and let the government try to do this. There's already the start of a revolt in the bond market that's beginning as a consequence of this realization. The guys in the bond market tend to be a little smarter than the guys in the stock market most of the time. But once that hits the mainstream consciousness, you're going to see a collapse in asset prices, because when you think about the cost of houses, for example, nobody buys a house, they buy a payment on a house. And so when you see a bond market dislocation, you're going to see the asset prices of essentially all capital assets, including stocks across the board, come apart, simply because what's been fueling this up until now has been the ever lower cost of borrowing, and that's going to stop. So this is a problem that has to be resolved, and I've been writing on it now since I began writing the market ticker, but my actual record on calling this out and looking at the trends goes back to when I ran my internet company in the 1990s, because we saw this in our premium patterns for our health insurance for our employees, and it was just absolutely obvious then, along with looking at the Treasury statements of the time, what was going to happen. And, it took 30 years. I thought it would take 30 years. But with the exception of a couple of year, blips, and that's essentially what Obama did. He bought himself 2 years of reprieve with a 2,000-page bill. Think about that. He forced people into the market. He threatened to fine them and put all these regulations in place. And what he got out of that was essentially a close to a halt in this acceleration for 2 years. And then it went right back to where it was.
You know, Carl, you know, when you mentioned the bond market collapsing, it was amazing to me, what we saw happen in the bond market this year. I mean, you only have to go back 4 months, and yields on the 30-year U.S. Treasury were just over 2%. Now they're over 3%. That's about a 50% increase in yield in a very short period of time. Is this the beginning of what, you know, Greece saw back at the time of the financial crisis? Are we going to see yields continually rise from here?
I don't know. The thing about repressing rates and distorting them, which the Federal Reserve, of course, engaged in a massive scale during the time of the crisis and really didn't take its thumb off the scale much since, is that you're essentially coiling a spring. And so how far you can go before something breaks is an unknown. With most things in the market, and this is not an exception, the market tends to react to psychology rather than underlying reality. So you never hit the actual financial or fiscal wall that you otherwise would face. You always get the panic moment when enough people wake up in the middle of the night in fear rather than greed and force that issue before you get to the wall. So people talk about, you know, like I put these numbers together and I say, you know, well, look, you know, in 4 or 5 years, the federal budget is hosed. The reality is that you won't get that far because somewhere before that date comes, it will get to the top of people's minds in the marketplace. And when it does, then the reaction happens as if you already hit the wall, even though it hasn't happened yet. And that's what happened in 2007. Remember, we had, you know, we had two little tiny hedge funds that blew up in the summer of 2007. And then we had Bear Stearns, which blew up in the spring of 2008. And people hadn't really stopped paying their mortgages yet. The real recession hadn't yet occurred. And yet Lehman Brothers exploded a few months later. And on the grand scheme of things, Lehman was a tiny little company. Okay, when you look at it in terms of the total share of the U.S. market as a bank, or the total world share of the financial system, Lehman was absolutely inconsequential, and yet it set off a panic that crashed the stock market from the S&P is in the 1500s down into the 600.
So, Carl, when you look at what's happened to the yields on U.S. Treasuries, and at the same time, look at the relative strength of the U.S. dollar. I mean, when you look at the strength of the dollar against the U.S.'s six major trading partners, the dollar has really broken out from a two-year trading range. How do you square that?
Oh, that's not hard. This is despite the attempts, this is deflation at work. This is what happens when you start sucking capital out of the economy. And you try to replace it with printed credit. Eventually, the spring breaks. And you know, it's funny. Back in the 07 timeframe, when the dollar was headed for sub 60, it looked like we were all going to go down the toilet with essentially the dollar going to zero. I noticed some internal stuff, and I had banged that drum for quite a while, and I started seeing changes in the pattern, and I said, you know what, when the facts change, you have to change your opinion. I said, no, look, I'm wrong here, okay? The dollar's not going to collapse in any way, and the people who are going to lose their shirts are the people that are thinking that oil's going to $250 a barrel and the dollar's going to 40. And ultimately, that proved to be right. I mean, it didn't happen in a day, but look at where we are now. The dollar is over 100. And oil is clawing its way back for $50. But at the end of the day, where does all this go? Well, we've had a 30-year secular trend in interest rates down. That the benign end of that trend is that it flatlines, in which case the continual turning of the crank of leverage that allows asset prices to go up stops, which means asset prices don't go up anymore. The malignant end of this is that rates reverse and start going up, and now the crank has to be unwound and asset prices crash.
Well, our guest today has been Mr. Carl Denninger. Carl has a blog that I would encourage you to check out. The site is market-ticker.org. Carl, always amazing how fast a couple segments goes by with you, but we sure appreciate you joining us today and hope you'll come back.
You bet, anytime. Thank you.
Well, that's about all the time we have for this segment of the Everything Financial Radio program. You know, if you're just tuning in, I pointed out at the beginning of the first and second segment of today's program that the Everything Financial Radio program is coming to an end. However, we do not want our relationship to come to an end. We're going to continue to produce resources that will benefit you, we believe, and keep you apprised as to where the economy's headed, where the marketing is headed, based on our belief that economies and monies cycle. And when you take a look at what's going on around the world today, it seems very obvious that these cycles do exist. And if you'd like to stay in touch, all you have to do is subscribe to our free newsletter. You can do that by visiting the website, yourportfoliowatch.com. That's Y-O-U-R, yourportfoliowatch.com. I'll be back after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program, brought to you by PLP Services. I have the pleasure in this segment of chatting with longtime friend of the Everything Financial Radio program, Mike Shedlock, otherwise known as Mish. I would encourage you to check out his prolific economic commentary at mishtalk.com. That's M-I-S-H talk.com, mishtalk.com. And Mish, welcome back to the program.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be on the show, Dennis. Time flies, but it's always a pleasure to be back on.
Well, I'm really pleased to have you. And I want to start, Mish, with a rather provocative post that you had not long ago. You said that the Fed helped elect Trump, and the subtitle was Tale of Two Job Markets. Explain.
Well, it's clear that the Fed is hell-bent on driving inflation higher. I've done two posts recently on who actually benefited from that. You're asking about the second one, A Tale of Two Jobs. I just quoted on a report from the ECRI, and I have a chart in there that they produced, not that I produced, that shows that Asians, Blacks, and Hispanics were the ones that really benefited from the increase in jobs since 2007. Now, that is on a labor participation adjusted basis, but the report claims that 29% of the jobs went to Asians, 56 went to Hispanics, and again, on an adjusted basis, whites actually lost 9% of the jobs. So they have a negative 9% of the net gain in of the total net gain in jobs. That coincides with a post that I wrote actually just the day before that, called A Decade of Real Negative Interest Rates and Who Benefited. And charts that I created, actually, in that post show that the median person is actually losing money over the last 10 years. You know, my charts, the way I constructed the chart, Dennis, was I took the interest rate, which has been sitting near zero for a really long time, and I subtracted the CPI from that, and the result has been negative for most of the last 10 years. What's happened in that time? We had a housing bubble, a crash, and then, if you believe me, we have a stock market bubble and a bond market bubble now. Meanwhile, the average person, the average median income in household is actually down over that period. These two things explain why people are angry, and they explain why Trump won the election.
You know, Mish, I had Gary Schilling on a few weeks ago, right after the election, and he commented the same comment as you: real purchasing power has declined over the last 10 years, and people are just angry. So do you think that you've seen anything from a policy perspective moving ahead under a Trump administration that's going to make this economy pick up and go, or do we have debt levels that are just too big for that to happen?
I would say we have debt levels that are too big for that to happen. And I also reported on that. I got so many comments, Dennis, from those two articles that I talked about that I did a follow-up post on productivity, stagnation, protectionism, and jobs. Everyone is expecting Trump to do something. In fact, he claimed that he's going to do something about jobs. And he actually went out there, and he claims now to have saved 1,000 jobs or so at Carrier and some jobs at Ford. I don't know if he listed a number at that. But we're talking here, okay, 1,000 jobs. assuming we give him credit for halting those jobs moving to Mexico or wherever. The fact of the matter is, though, we've lost millions of jobs in the last 10 years, and NAFTA and China are the scapegoat for that. China is losing manufacturing jobs now. Manufacturing production in the U.S. is actually up. It's more and more of this is being done by robots. So no matter how much people want to believe that Trump is going to do something and bring these jobs back, the realistic assessment is these jobs are not coming back. And there's no other way to look at it. And I went further and I said, you know, what's interesting here, Dennis, is the Fed, even Janet Yellen, is worried about declining productivity. They believe that that's part of the problem. I turned around and said, wait a second here. Millions of jobs by 22, 24 time frame, I'm talking about long-haul trucking jobs, are just going to vanish. We are going to have automated trucks on the road, self-driving. Perhaps not to the final destination point in cities, but the technology is there right now. And DOT, the Department of Transportation, has gone so far as to actually embrace this technology. States are competing with each other. Ohio ran tests last week and is actually, you know, putting in some sensors alongside the road to help speed up the process. If that's what it takes, that's what's going to happen. And so we're going to see a huge bump in just delivery productivity, if nowhere else, because we're going to go from millions of people driving these trucks, literally, to zero people driving these trucks over long hauls. That's what's going to happen. And then think about the effects of that. Think about taxi drivers. Think about, you know, other services. It's not a pretty picture that I'm painting.
So, Mish, you know, often when there is a big, massive change, like self-driving vehicles, and that whole technology fascinates me, although admittedly I don't know much about it. Often there are opportunities created in other areas. Do you see that being the case this time?
Well, my long-term belief is that productivity and technology creates jobs. You know, because these same kinds of arguments could have been presented at any time in history. You know, automobiles replaced horses. Sewing machines replaced people doing it by hand. Now we've got, you know, robots, you know, almost building entire cars by themselves now. There were always jobs. We went from a nation where 90% of the people were farmers to a nation where, is it even 1% now are farmers? So there's always jobs. But during these disruptions, there are periods of times sometimes where technology adds masses of jobs, and then we have something called creative destruction, which we're in a period of right now where sometimes those jobs vanish. So the long-term effects, I think, are still good for all of these things, but the short-term effects don't necessarily have to be so good. And the short-term effects in this case are necessarily bad simply because of Fed policy. Central banks in general, they're striving like mad to force up inflation, price inflation, at a time when technology is increasingly pushing prices the other way. You know, that is actually one of the factors why we lost the jobs to Mexico and China in the first place. Now productivity is taking over, and the jobs are simply vanishing everywhere. So, you know, I don't know. Long term, I believe something's going to come up in the energy front. Something's going to come up somewhere. I sure wish I could tell you where. That's going to create jobs. Look at the Internet, how many jobs it created. Then, once it got so powerful, things started automating, and we started losing jobs. So we're in a period now where productivity improvements are taking jobs away, and people are angry about it, but Fed policy is making things worse. Rather than let prices go down, incomes, because of the massive supply of labor and the increase in robots, is at an increasing disadvantage here. And the Fed has the wrong policy.
So, Mitch, if you were to take over for Janet Yellen, what would Fed policy be?
That's a good. Well, the first thing I would do is fire myself.
I love it. Let's get rid of the Fed.
Let's get rid of the Fed. More seriously, we need to be thinking about how we get away from central banks determining interest rates. We need to go to market-based structure. We need a free market in money, and I'm quite positive the free market would choose gold and or gold and silver simply because they have been money for 3,000 years or more, whenever governments allowed that to be money. That's what people used. Now, the only reason why people use dollars rather than gold is because they have to pay their taxes in dollars by mandate, by government, in collusion with central banks. They've forced interest rates negative. Three-quarters of the world's bonds trade with negative interest rates. That cannot happen in the real world without government force, without central bank force. It's like saying one would rather have 90 cents today than a dollar tomorrow. It makes no sense, but that's what they've done. So we have all of these economic distortions. There's no price discovery. Back to what I would do, I would try and get the Fed out of the interest rate setting business and simply let the market set rates. Long haul, I would like to abolish the Fed and fractional reserve lending.
Well, we'll talk more about that with Mr. Mitch Shedlock in the next segment. Stay with us. The Everything Financial Radio program continues after these words. You are listening to the Everything Financial Radio program. Welcome back. The Everything Financial Radio program is brought to you each week by PLP Services. Glad you tuned in today. Hey, if you're just joining us, I wanted to let you know that the Everything Financial Radio program is coming to an end. There's an old saying that all good things eventually come to an end, and the Everything Financial Radio program, hopefully you think, is among them. We are stopping the radio program to spend more time researching and writing and reaching folks in a different way, and we certainly want our relationship with you to continue. So if you're not yet a subscriber to our Portfolio Watch newsletter, I would invite you to subscribe. It's easy. All you need to do is visit yourportfoliowatch.com. That's the website, yourportfoliowatch.com, and you can sign up there for a free newsletter that's delivered every Monday at 5 p.m. Joining me on today's program, Mr. Mitch Shedlock. If you're not familiar with Mitch's writings, I'd encourage you to check it out. You can read his blog at mitchtalk.com. And, Mitch, let's jump in where we left off. In the last segment, you'd mentioned that one of the things you would do is ultimately abolish the Fed, but get the Fed out of the interest rate setting business. You know, when you look at what's happened to yields on the 30-year U.S. Treasury bond, you've seen yields go up almost 50% from a little over like 2.1% to just over 3% today. So U.S. government bonds have really tanked, if you will, over the last 4 months or so. To what do you attribute that?
Well, I attribute that to a couple of things. The market realizes, hey, you know, things might not be all that bad under Trump. Remember how all these people were wrong, the stock market was going to collapse, treasury yields were going to collapse, blah, 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 the exact opposite had. Same people were wrong about the election of Trump, they were wrong about Brexit. I think they're wrong about the odds of some right-wing candidates winning in France and Austria coming up. But let's return back to the USA. In the last, or since July 6th, mortgage rates have risen 85 basis points. That's 0.8%, 0.5%. So people's the rate at which one can get a mortgage has jumped almost, and that was actually as of a few days ago, has jumped almost a full percentage point. That is going to take a huge bite out of the amount of house someone can afford. It's going to stop the refi market overnight. Refis are totally dead. Anyone who hasn't refinanced before is not going to be able to do it profitably now. Maybe they can still refinance, but why would they want to unless they have to? So that's what we're looking here in the home market. Meanwhile, the dollar has risen. That is going to hurt U.S. exports. At what point does this hike in interest rates begin to spill over into the stock market? I think it's just a matter of time. All the people who were so dead bang on sure that Trump would sink the markets have now switched 180 degrees. They're waving the victory flag, thinking that the stock market is going to keep rising here forever. Well, all of these forces here are the rising dollar is deflationary. The upcoming productivity, the loss of jobs in self-driving vehicles, I mean, that's 8 years down the road or so. That's very deflationary. Events happening in China and Europe right now are very deflationary. And to top all of that off, if Trump does what he claims he was going to do, which was renegotiate deals with China unilaterally, put tariffs on Chinese goods if they don't comply, that is a very, very destructive trade policy. We risk a major collapse in global trade. We're already seeing that. Threats from that between the UK and Europe, who are bickering over how to get the UK out of the EU. All of this is just a simmering pot of deflationary stew just waiting and waiting to happen. I think another asset bubble bust is coming. It's going to be interesting to see how the Fed, central banks in general, respond to that.
Well, that was going to be my next question, Mitch. Do you think they go to quantitative easing number whatever now? Do they turn on the printing press again?
Larry Summers actually was discussing he's an economist. I think he was formerly Treasury Secretary, perhaps, discussing the Fed actually buying stock markets, buying the equity. They're doing that now in Japan to pump up the Japanese stock market. The theory here is that it's going to get people to spend. All it's doing is exacerbating real problems. We've had three massive bubbles since 2000, and if a rising stock market was, the answer to the world's troubles, we wouldn't have these rising debt income problems that we see. Instead, the Fed is, some say purposely, may perhaps accidentally, I don't know whether they know what they're doing or not. Certainly they've targeted asset prices. They've mentioned that. But the average person doesn't have a lot of stocks outside their IRA. They can't easily take this wealth and spend it. Some people don't have any stocks at all. Meanwhile, the Fed has put a little bit of a floor under prices of goods and services. Obamacare premiums have skyrocketed through the roof. I believe that's undercounted in the CPI. Rents, I believe, are undercounted in the CPI. So we have this benign sort of look at things. But the average guy, just on the basis of anger alone, you know they're falling further and further behind. And these Fed policies have since have exacerbated this problem, but history says it's the only thing they know how to do. They're going, if we have another deflationary bust, they are going to try and stop it. The beneficiary of that next go-around, I don't think is going to be the stock market. I think it's likely to be gold.
I would agree, and we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Mitch Shedlock. You can get his blog, or you can find his blog, I should say, at mishtalk.com. And, Mitch, thanks for joining us.
Oh, always a pleasure to be on. Look forward to next time.
Well, that's about all the time we have for the Everything Financial Radio program this week. But in the 2 minutes or so I have left, let me just comment briefly on the election. Although there weren't many things that I heard during the campaign that I was very attracted to, the one thing that I was attracted to was the whole idea that for every regulation that you put in place, you should eliminate two of them. To me, that makes good sense because regulations have gotten to be, in a word, ridiculous. To prove my point, many of you may be aware of the fact that the state of California recently implemented a law or a regulation that requires the state to cut methane emissions from dairy cows by 40% by 2030. Now, for those of you that are not familiar with the anatomy of a dairy cows put methane into the atmosphere when they flatulate. Well, the state of California think that's a bad idea because those methane emissions are evidently harmful, and they are requiring that these methane emissions be reduced by 40% by 2030. Well, there's an organization called the Western United Dairymen who commented, and basically they said that there's no way to do that. There's no such thing as a cow muffler. They can't make it happen. So what's happening? Well, dairies are closing and moving out of the state of California. The unintended consequence? It's a food tax on all of us because dairy production will decline. I certainly hope moving ahead that the recent election at least has a little bit of common sense showing back up in government, although I'm not holding my breath. That's all the time we have for this week. Again, our newsletter is available at yourportfoliowatch.com. Have a great week.